Hello, in this audio snippet, we'd like to continue talking about the branches of government as we shared before. The current three branch division in the American system is fundamentally flawed. It has imperfections. It looks nice and clean on the outside, but when you start looking into the details and delve deeper into it, you see that there are inconsistencies within it, and it's because it's not a reflection of metaphysical realities about the human personality. So we're talking about how the system needs to be reorganized to be consistent with metaphysical reality. Because once you align your model of government to the metaphysical reality that's independent of you, that reflects how human nature is, how the reality of the outside world is, then your model will be consistent. It will work. You can create a model whichever way you want, but if it's not, doesn't match the reality of the outside world or of humanity, the human nature, then it's bound to run into problems and difficulties, which is what the American system, the current American system, ran into, and that's all part of why the American Republic died on the 5th of November 2008, and then the whole country died as we, as a people, became unwilling to let go of the old and let in the truth. So in the previous recording, we talked about the first three branches, and we want to get to the other two. The first three were the House of Representatives or Congress, whichever way you want to call it. And the second branch was the House of Sentries, Sentries, S-E-N-T-R-I-E-S, the House of Sentries. And the other branch would be the President himself. We saw that the Congress is related to the judge personality of human nature. The House of Sentries is related to the visionary personality of human nature. And the President is related to the conqueror personality of human nature. So that means that three of the five human personalities have been covered. So that means that the other two branches will be related to the server personality and the organizer personality. So that's what we'll hopefully get into, and I don't think we'll be able to finish the whole thing, but at least we hope to start with some general ideas and then tie some loose ends in a future recording. So this is going to sound confusing a little bit, but I hope that once you see it, I think it will make sense and become very clear and very it will go from being a little bit confusing at the beginning to being very, very straightforward and very simple and very clear, I hope, at the end. So instead of just jumping in to talk about the other two branches, we're going to talk about something that you might think is like separate, but it really isn't. And this is where the confusion can start, but I hope that it clears up very quickly. And what we're going to talk about is departments. In other words, departments that are going to exist in government. And like, for example, in America, we have the Department of Labor, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, I think it's called, and the Department of education and so forth. So we have these different departments, and currently, under the current system, all these departments, which are supposed to execute or carry out the laws passed by Congress, are under the executive branch, and they're under the President. And that's where the conflict kind of starts, as we described before, because the President at that point becomes a manager. For example, if you think of a restaurant, the restaurant obviously has an owner. He or she, bought the place, and he or she wants it to be a place that serves fried chicken, let's say, or who knows, or hamburgers. And as the owner, that person has the right to decide what the restaurant's going to sell. So his or her will be supreme. So, but because, you know, let's say it's a he, just to avoid doing the he-she thing all the time. Let's say it's a he. Then let's say he, you know, he has other things to do, but he bought the place. So he is going to hire a manager. So he hires a manager who comes in, and he will tell the manager, hey, I want to sell fried chicken or hamburgers or whatever. And I'd like the restaurant to be this style. I want the service to be given in a certain way. I want the restaurant to have a certain theme. Let's say he likes the color blue, so he wants blue to be kind of the predominant color inside the place, and so forth. So he hires this manager, gives him the ideas, what he wants the restaurant to be and look like. And then the manager will then carry out the owner's will. And he's responsible to the manager to tell him, hey, you know, I've done this, and this. And if he hasn't done something, he's accountable and so forth. And if he has a disagreement with the owner about how to do things, then he has to slug it out with the owner until they can come. He can convince him that it has to be done a different way in case the owner is not seeing it right. But at all times, the manager is the one is in a position of I don't know the word submission, but no, that would be an incorrect term. He's a subordinate, let's put it that way, under the owner, and his job is to carry out the will of the owner, you know, obviously without compromising his principles and so forth. But so when we have all these departments under the president, we put the president in a position of a manager, where the owner in this example would be Congress, because Congress is the one passing the laws and telling the president, hey, you have to execute or carry out these laws and implement them. And then that's where the thing starts, because the president is supposed to be a position of power, an authority, head authority. And then you suddenly put him in a position of a manager who is under the Congress. And then and because he is, in some cases, clearly a head figure, then it will get into his head that he can decide how to run things, because he's like the owner. You see what I'm saying? So it creates this very peculiar conflict of interest, where the president either becomes a servant of Congress, or he becomes a king of his own and tweaks or modifies what the Congress asked him to do, which is what ends up happening. And that's why the president feels the need to add his own executive orders to the legislation that's been passed, and then he suddenly decides, well, I don't like that law, so I'm going to pretend like it's not there, and I'm just going to issue an executive order overriding that law or kind of circumventing that law so that I won't have to enforce it. So it becomes because you're asking someone who is in a position of a conqueror to then act as a manager. So that's all messed up. So the departments are not going to be under the executive branch, because you don't want the president to be a manager, because it's not consistent with the nature of the position. The personality of conqueror is not consistent with being a manager, because a manager has to submit himself to someone else's wills and intentions. It just does not work like that. The departments will then, so where will all these departments be? Well, the departments, whichever they may be, will be under the House of Representatives. Why? Because why would you create a Department of Labor? Because you want, I'm not a fan of the Department of Labor, but let's just use that as an example. It's the first thing that came to my mind. Why did they create the Department of Labor? Because they wanted a department that enact or that implemented all the stupid laws that Congress has passed over the years regarding labor. So they need someone to enforce all those laws, create the forms, all the stupid forms, and then all the to keep track of all the whether or not the owners of businesses are abiding by all the labor requirements and paying all the benefits or whatever. So they needed a department that took care of all of that. In other words, someone who to implement all labor-related legislation. So departments are implementers of legislation. That's what they are. So that's why you have to put them under their boss. Who is the owner in this example? Congress. Congress is passing the laws and saying, this is what we want. So he's the owner. And the department then becomes like the people in the heads of this of the department becomes like a manager, that is to carry out the laws that are being passed by Congress. So that's why all departments, no matter what they are, will all be under the House of Representatives, because they are there to execute the laws. So then when you have it that way, there's no conflict of interest. There's no one saying, well, no, I'm a manager. So if I am a head of a department, I am a manager who has been hired to execute or implement laws passed by someone else. I'm not the president. I'm not a head of state. Then I won't have this urge to, or natural, or the people who will be hired for these things will have more of a subordinate mindset to carry out what Congress passes. So they won't be tempted, or because the president, as we were saying, is not it has a personality of a conqueror. So he will want to do whatever he wants. And that's not how it is. They are executors of the law. So there is no executive branch anymore. There is the branch of the president, and we will talk about that maybe in the next audio snippet if possible, to clear up what the branch of the president is. Yeah, basically it's he is the branch, but he has some people under him, and part of that is the army and all that, or the military, but we'll talk about that maybe later. The thing is that there is no executive branch, no branch to execute the laws, the legislative. That's not his job. His job is something else. So, okay. So all departments under Congress, under the direct control of Congress. And also this, so because of that, there are two conflicts that I think we mentioned before that would get resolved. First, there, as we have already said, no injection of a president's will that may interfere with the signed legislation. So because the president is not the one in charge of these departments, he cannot have a direct influence on them, because the head of the Department of Education doesn't have to answer to the president when he or she does something. He or she has to answer to Congress, because he or she is there to enforce or to apply or implement all education related legislation. So the president he has an influence, as we tried to explain before, but it's an indirect influence, not a direct influence. He's not the boss of the Department of Education, because he's a separate branch. So so that's one conflict that's resolved. The other is that there is no hand tying, as I would call it, of a president, because he cannot, let's say, fire someone that's not doing what he, as manager, wants them to do, which is the problem we've had because of, I think the act is called the Pendleton Act, and so there's some civil service reform acts that have been passed over the years starting during the post-Reconstruction period, that have created all this mess about who or how a president can hire or fire people. So we have an administration that comes in and is able to put some people in certain positions, and then in the next election, another president with a different mentality, you could say, or political party or perspective comes in, and he can't implement his what he wants to do because he has to deal with all the people from the previous administration that are in these bureaucratic positions that he cannot fire. Sometimes he can get away with doing what he wants, but sometimes he can't. And then sometimes these people who are left in these positions act as nothing but hindrances and stumbling blocks because they want to blockade everything that this president wants them to do because they don't like him or they don't like his policies. So all of that conflict is eliminated if all these departments are under Congress because they have to answer to Congress. And Congress will be the one. See, the thing is, the president has to answer to Congress many times to in order to hire or fire people. Now there's nothing like Congress is accountable to itself about who it hires to be put into these departments. So that conflict is gone, and the other thing that the other thing is that we have to eliminate all this layer of civil service reform that was added in the post-Reconstruction period. And as we tried to explain before, after as we started getting away from 1865 and moving on beyond the end of the Civil War in America, the Republican Party became focused on two things, two little things, two baby rattles, as I'd call them, that distracted their attention from the main task. One was civil service reform and the end of the spoil system, and we'll try to talk about that maybe later. And we've already mentioned it in part before. And the other thing is the gold standard. Those two things started distracting Republicans, and I think it was almost as a deliberate, willful distraction. Like they wanted to be distracted by someone else because they didn't want to deal with the real thing they had to deal with, which was the liberation of black people in the South. They had been technically, legally been set free, quote unquote, after the end of the Civil War. But, the reality was that they were not free. And the Republican Party decided in 1876 that the reason why they were born was no longer a valid reason to fight for. So they gave up. The Republican Party was born to protect black people. That's the root cause of it, the root of the party, why it was born. And they shied away from it, and they started focusing on the civil service stuff. And as they started passing legislation to end the spoil system, the spoil system used to be a system where in America where people were given government jobs if they had been contributing to the political, to the person who got elected. If they contributed financially or were buddies or there was some sort of financial interest between them, between the elected person and someone else, then that this someone else would get preferential treatment and be put in positions of power in government. But all of that, the solution all of that had issues, obviously, but the solution that was implemented just made things worse. It apparently, and I say that in large quotes, it apparently solved a problem, but it actually created a whole bunch of other problems, and it just created the culture of bureaucracy, people who will stay in bureaucratic positions for decades and decades and just stink up the place with stagnation and stonewalling and all this other stuff. When the solution should have been different. And the spoil system was not that much of a problem. I think some people started exaggerating the nature of the problem and try to apply the wrong solution to it. So we would get away from all of that. And so how would appointments be? Pretty straightforward. Congress will appoint the people in charge of all departments and monitor their performance. And all appointments will be via legislative bills. Simple as that. And in other words, if there's a vacancy, let's say we need someone in charge of the Department of Education, then and now the difference is because it's not directly related to the will of one individual, we don't have to worry about individual petty interests being involved in that person being nominated for the position. Because it's not just the president, it's going to be Congress. So in other words, if we need to fill up the position for Department of Education, what do? Well, then we come up with names. Then MC, and by MC we mean, I mean member of Congress, and I'll use that just to make my life easier. MC, member of Congress, in other words, a representative in the House. One MC will say, hey, let's hire John Doe. And another MC is going to say, oh, let's hire Jane Smith. And another MC is going to say Peter Fonda or whatever. And they will propose these. They will write this simple bill. I propose a bill that assigns so-and-so to the position of head of the Department of Education. So he posts that bill just like he can post any other bill, as we've described before. Any MC can do that and post a bill about anything as long as it fulfills some very objective technical requirements of size and single topic and other things that we talked about before. So he proposes the bill. I want so-and-so to be the head of the Department of Education, and another person will post another bill about someone else. So all these bills will be in the system, and the other MCs can and they can talk amongst themselves and discuss, they go walking up and down the halls of Congress and talk to each other and say, hey, Jane Smith is the best one for this job because of this, that, and the other. So they all debate, during the lunch break, they go to the Congress cafeteria and they talk amongst themselves and they discuss it and so forth. So so-and-so who nominated Jane Smith can start convincing a whole bunch of other MCs to support that nomination. So they will go to the bill that he posted, that this MC posted, saying the bill declaring Jane Smith the head of the Department of Education and give it a thumbs up, just like with any other bill. And then the bills who acquire a certain number of thumbs up go to the top of the queue, and they get voted on by the entire Congress. And then if the Congress passes the bill, then Jane Smith becomes the head of the Department of Education. See, now there's no concern about, did Jane Smith donate to the campaign of so-and-so and so-and-so? Maybe she donated to the campaign of the MC that nominated her, but the decision is made by an entire Congress of hundreds of people. So as you can see, the spoil system there kind of gets diluted. And again, the spoil system also had to do with the problem of campaign finance, which, as we've described before, would be very simply solved by a very simple solution. We won't get into that, but the thing is that the spoil system wouldn't be a problem at all by changing the campaign finance reform system and changing also the fact that the government changing the government salaries and saying, okay, no one in government can make more than 1.5 times the national household average, and then it would just deter a lot of people who would want a position of government for the sake of the money and the power, they would just go away because they would rather make money somewhere else. But the thing is that the spoil system would not be a problem, and there'd be no restriction on when you can hire or fire anyone. I mean, if the department, the head of the Department of Education is doing a lousy job and she's been there for 5 months, then no, you know, then someone else can say, hey, you know, the House of Sentries could complain about the terrible job the Department of Education is doing and do a declaration the way we described in the previous audio snippet. And that will get the attention of the MCs, and one MC will say, "Well, let's try John Doe." So he will propose John Doe in a bill, and it will go through the same process. And John Doe will take over, and John Doe will be in, and Jane Smith will be out. Simple as that. But no limitation. Oh, we have to get a 75% majority vote in the Congress to oust Jane Smith. If Jane Smith is doing a lousy job, let her be gone. Or if the Congress thinks that she's doing a lousy job, let her be gone. You know, it is what it is. But we can't have this entrenchment of bureaucrats in the system. They're not doing their job. So that'd be the very simple way. Just clarify, when an MC submits a candidate, it will be a bill with a single candidate. So it's saying, I endorse, it's not even saying I endorse. The bill will say, Jane Smith will become the next Department of Education, starting such and such date, or starting immediately. That's the bill, and then people will vote on whether that bill will become law or not. So, okay. Now, all these departments will have regulations, but all the regulations will operate that these departments will operate under, or that all the regulations that they will enforce on the American people will be set by Congress through voted legislation. Nothing of this delegation of legislation to an agency like the FDA or whatever. And Congress just giving it over. And then the FDA is in a different branch, so it gets out of the reach of Congress. So Congress is delegating legislative powers to some agency that's in a completely independent branch. See the conflict. That's why the system was destined to fail. But if the FDA says, you know, all children below the age of 5 have to get such and such injection, they can't just pull it out of their butt and force everyone to comply with that. No, if they want to enforce a regulation on the American people, they have if the department that's related to medication in some way. Thinks that it's a good idea to for children to have a certain injection, then they should propose it. So they can submit. So these departments, they will be able to propose a change. Now the details of that can vary. What I believe would be the best would be the head of the Department of Education wants to implement some change in the education system, then he or she would be allowed to walk the halls of Congress and go talk to the MCs and start convincing them that hey, we need this change, and then get one of the MCs to draft a bill. Now, I'm not too clear on whether, let's say, head of a department would have the authority to propose a bill and put it into the queue of Congress. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. Maybe it might be to expedite the process, but I believe it might be at the beginning easier to just have him or her try to convince at least one MC to propose the bill, and then once the bill is proposed, and it will go through the normal system. But everything that is imposed on the American people through a department has to come from a bill approved by Congress. And as such, then the other two branches, the House of Centuries and the President, will have an influence on whether or not that change can be implemented or be enacted, because they can affect legislation, as we were describing before. The Centuries can influence legislation and sometimes veto it if they have a two-thirds majority to veto. But they may not have the two-thirds majority, but they may have enough people to make declarations to tell the American people, hey, we don't agree with what they're trying to change in the Department of Education. And the president can also has the power to veto the bill if he does not agree with that change. So the thing is that everyone has some influence in whether the change is done. It's not just this Department of Education willy-nilly on its own deciding we're going to make this change, or it's the department in charge of medical stuff deciding, hey, all these kids now have to be injected, and who died and made them king. So that problem would be resolved. So they can propose changes, but they cannot set regulations on their own, these departments. And having said this, the House of Centuries, as we were saying before, has this responsibility of checking legislation, checking the spirit of legislation, and checking other things. They are the guards, they are the sentries. That's why they're called the House of Centuries. So one of their duties as sentries will also be to oversee and discern the spirit with which these departments are run, and if they find something wrong, they can make declarations, just like they can, as we described before, or even propose a bill, as we described before, that deal with the issues and concerns that they're seeing. So if they see something wrong, they can make a declaration, maybe not a non-binding declaration, a public declaration to tell the American people, or not the American people, because America's dead, but whichever people we're talking about, to tell them that there's an issue here in the Department of Education or the Department of whatever. There's something wrong here. We don't have all the evidence, but we suspect that there's something. So it's kind of like calling out Congress, like, hey, Congress, we're just told the American people that you have something rotten in Denmark. Somewhere in the department of such and so-and-so, there's something fishy going on. You have to go fix it. So that will be part of their role. And also the president can make declarations when he or she sees that, like, a department is not aligning itself with the will of the people or his will, because he embodies, as we said before, the will of the people. So if he's been talking to people and the people have been complaining about the department of so-and-so, then he can make a declaration, an official declaration, and tell Congress, I heard that the American people don't like this. And he can also inject his own will, because he's kind of a mixture. He embodies the will, so it doesn't mean that he's just an echo of the American people. He has his own will, but the people elected him because they trusted his will. So it's as if he embodies the will of the American people, and the American people, well, I keep saying American people, but it's going to be some other people. But the people have entrusted him and said, hey, I think you're aligned with our will, but when you get to the position of president, you do your thing. But we hope that you will not forget our will, because you are supposed to embody our will. That's why we elected you there. But you have a will of your own as a human being. So the president sees that there's something going on in certain departments that is not in accordance with his will, he can also make declarations. He can influence public opinion and put the pressure on the MCs to make changes if a change is really needed. And just as another side note, it's important to emphasize there's not going to be a Department of Defense the way we have in America right now. The Department of Defense is basically the Department of War. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they should call it Department of War, but I guess that sounded too belligerent, so they just changed it to something more passive, defense, like I'm defending myself, but war is aggressive. It shouldn't be called defense. But the thing is that the Department of War, or Department of Defense, as we call it in America now, is not a department that enforces regulations, legislative regulations, or doesn't enforce legislation or does not implement legislation in any way. So you can't have them under Congress. They should, because they have to do with the military, then they should be under the president, because the president is the one in control of the military. He is the commander-in-chief, the leader of the country, the representative of the country to the rest of the world. So the Department of Defense would be something inside the president branch, the branch of the president. And the CIA would also be under the president, because the CIA is basically the secret operations of the military. That's what they are. They're the military secret operations. So again, they'd come under the president. They would not be under the Congress. So we've more or less defined or tried to explain the concept of departments and how they would operate in a general sense. So now there are going to be two classifications of departments. There's going to be enforcement departments and implementation departments. And this is where it starts getting a little confusing, but I hope it's very clear. The enforcement departments are the ones that enforce the laws, like make sure that people comply with the laws. The implementation departments are the ones who establish, let's say, the regulations, the procedures, and provide services that are required by the legislation. Let's say that a piece of legislation says that, I'm just making up a silly example just to say something. Let's say that there's a legislation passed that says that people who are over the age of 65 get a free soda every Thursday. Then that's not something that behooves an enforcement department, because it's not like a law that you're forcing on people to comply with. It's a legislation that says, you know, people over 60 will get a free soda every Thursday. So that means that there's going to be a department that has to implement the mechanism to provide that free soda to every person over 60 every Thursday. So it's an implementation of a legislation that's not related to enforcement. It's not like, if you don't drink your soda, you're going to be put in jail. It's not like that. So that's why it's two different classifications, enforcement and implementation, if that makes any sense. Now, the enforcement department will still be just like any other department under Congress, but they are kind of very strictly attached to them. So we're still not talking about the other two branches that we need to talk about. So that's why I think that's where the confusion might start. But let's pretend there's no server or organizer branch. So let's just think about enforcement. So these departments, and basically there will be three. We have had this kind of explosion of departments and all these bureaus and all this stuff that we have in the American system because we've just been winging it. We've been kind of ad-libbing the whole thing the whole time. So, and it comes from something we one day will maybe talk about in some audio snippet about the nature, one of the problems with the nature of the American psyche that led to many of the problems we have now. And it was something we had from the very beginning. And I always associated with a certain philosopher that I shall not name until later. But there's a certain philosopher that I always resent because I believe he had a lot to do with helping ingrain that mentality in us. And it's just a problem in the American psyche. And it's been very helpful, that quality or trait or flaw is helpful in some ways, but it gets to the point where if you keep applying that same trait over and over again, it becomes a very, very limiting quality. So because of that quality, which we'll talk about some other day, if allowed, then we have created all this mess of departments without metaphysically analyzing. But I believe that in terms of enforcement, only three departments are needed, and that's all we need. And we'll see with the other departments that basically they can be compressed into a simple list instead of the plethora of things of departments we have now. But the three enforcement departments will be they are the three P's, as they say in a certain commercial that runs in America all the time. The three P's. And that commercial is price, but it's, I don't know why it's three P's. It seems like it's one P because they're all price, but I digress. The thing is that the three departments are going to be the police, the prosecutors, and prison. The police is obviously the... all the people who work to force people to abide by law and dealing with the people who refuse to abide by a law, and it's going to be just the police. That's all it is. For example, the FBI, the thing we have now, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in America, there shouldn't be any such thing as a separate agency doing its thing. You every time on television on these crime shows, they always drama shows, they tend to always portray this conflict between the FBI and local police, where the FBI tries to take over a case and the local police fight to keep control of the case and not lose jurisdiction and all this stuff, you know, all this internal battle that goes on. All that would be gone because it'd be one homogeneous branch of government, the police, from the head on down. So, there's no state police, there's no, and by that I mean a state police as we have it now in America, or city police, it's police, police, everybody is police. There's no like, if a crime is committed, there's a border, between two states. And the crime is committed right on the edge of the border, let's say between Texas and Arkansas. Then, if it's on the Texas border, then the police of Texas can grab the guy. And if he's in Arkansas, then the police of Arkansas can grab the guy. And even though the guy in Texas killed a guy from Arkansas, like 1 foot away from the border with Arkansas, the police of Arkansas, if let's say that they were right there, They were right there. They saw the murder. They can't cross the line into Texas and arrest the Texas guy who just killed the Arkansas guy. I could be wrong on this, but as far as I know, you can't do that. Unless there's an explicit law that allows police. But as far as I understand, a police from one state cannot arrest someone in another state. They cannot. Someone who committed a crime in another state. So it's ridiculous. No, police is police. If I'm a policeman and I see a guy getting killed, it doesn't matter what state they're, you know, the crime was committed, if there's a state line. I mean, he's 5 feet away from me. I'm going to catch him and arrest him. And it's a very homogeneous department from the head on down, nationally, all the way down. For example, in America, we have the immigration, the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is in charge of enforcing immigration law. And we have this situation where if a crime, let's say an illegal alien commits a crime and gets arrested, and the INS finds out that the guy is arrested, they want to deport him. They have to file a request to the local police department to say, can you please, I forget the name of it. There's a legal name for it. And they say, detainer. I think it's a detainer saying, please hold him until we can go and pick him up so that we can deport him. And usually local police just ignore the detainer or pretend like they didn't get it and do all these things, or let him go just before the immigration people show up. It is ridiculous. There's not going to be anything like and there's a conflict there because the INS is in the executive branch, and the police is this independent, local police is this independent thing that is controlled by City Hall, by another executive branch that is unrelated. It is dysfunctional. This is dysfunctional. It's crazy. So in the new constitution, all police will be responsible to enforce all the law. So even though obviously there may be levels of specialization. So maybe certain police people will be specialized in art, art crime, like when they do fake paintings. You know, maybe a traffic cop may look at a painting and say, I have no idea if this is a fake or not. So obviously there might be specializations, mm-hmm. But if I'm a police officer and I know that a law has been broken, I am responsible for enforcing that law. If I'm aware that the law has been broken, I am. My duty as a police officer is to enforce all the law, all the law that I'm aware of. And I'm not gonna. I can't be selective. Like, oh, I like this law. I don't like this law. Oh, that's not my department. That's not my branch. If I'm a homicide detective. And I see a woman getting robbed. She wasn't killed, but she was robbed and is being severely beaten. I'm not going to say, hey, I'm a homicide detective. That's not my jurisdiction, not my job. It's not my cup of tea. So I'm just going to watch because I'm going to call. Maybe I'm going to call someone who is in charge of theft and assault or whatever, and I'm going to get him or her to come and deal with it. But in the meantime, even though I'm like 5 feet away, I'm just going to let it be. No, that's ridiculous. If I know that a crime is being committed, a law is being broken, I have to enforce it. So if I am a traffic cop and I know this, I know so-and-so is an illegal alien, and I know it. I know it for a fact. I should have the responsibility to arrest him. And especially, let's say that I know somehow that this illegal alien was to be deported, and they're looking to catch him. Then I may be a traffic cop, but I'm going to arrest him. Oh, it's not my
my area, my jurisdiction? Yes, it is. The whole law is your jurisdiction. The whole law. So all police will be responsible to enforce all the law, even though that doesn't mean that certain police will be trained to specialize in certain crimes. And just to give you an example, as I was thinking about all these things, and it was interesting because I was watching a television show and I was thinking about all these things. And there was in this show that I was barely watching, the television was on it, but I paid attention enough to know that there was a lady that participated in some sort of murder, and I think it was in Washington or Oregon. I wasn't paying attention enough, but I think it was somewhere in the northwest of the United States. So let's say it was Oregon. I'm not sure, but so she participated in a crime, and she fled the northwest, and they couldn't find her. And then turns out that, apparently they put out a national APB or whatever to let other states know in case she showed up elsewhere. But the thing is, she ended up in Maryland, which is all the way across the country on the other coast, the East Coast. And how was she found in Maryland? Because she was stopped by a state trooper on a traffic violation. I don't remember if they said what violation it might have been. It might have been speeding. Who knows what? But she was stopped on that violation by a state trooper. Or traffic, I don't know. The thing is that this person saw something in her car and began to put two and two together and said, I think this person, I forget, because I think he inspected the car or something, but he saw something in the car, or I don't remember the details. The thing is, he realized, this person might be on the run. So he reported the person, but by the time, and I don't know if he was able to detain her for a while. I don't remember the details because I wasn't paying attention too much. But by the time that the Oregon or Washington police, were notified and they were finally able to serve an arrest warrant to the Maryland police, by that time the person had gone, and they weren't. But they had her in Maryland, ready to just be taken and then given over to the Oregon police, if it was Oregon. But Oregon had to go through this whole process of serving an arrest warrant saying, Maryland, please, can you please detain this person until we can pick her up? And no. And it's not as if we were living back in the 1850s where, to get information across, you had to get on a horse on a train and ride across the country for days and days until you got to the other side and gave the information that you wanted. I mean, we're living in an instant age. This was not that long ago. The show was not a recent show, but it was not like from 1965 or anything. It was, I would dare say, from the 1990s or 2000s that this incident happened. But it's just an example of, and the thing is, this guy was enforcing traffic laws, but he was proactive and said no. He could have said, if she murdered someone in some other state, not only is it not my branch of the law that I have to enforce, it's not even the state that I have to enforce the law in. So he could have just looked the other way, but he was proactive, but he didn't have the authority to detain her because of all this balkanization of the police system we have in America. So that's an example, and I felt like that was being shown to me as an example of the necessity of having a unified police system, very unified, where all police are responsible to enforce all the law. So that that's in a very broad strokes what the police would be, the internal qualities of it, maybe are not worth debating, but it would be a uniform police. There's no FBI, like separate FBI doing their own thing. It's just the police, and all police enforcing all the law, all the whole country. So even if it's a law that was for something that happened in some other state, it's still every policeman's in the country responsibility to enforce that law. Okay, so, you know, because there might be laws that have a local scope that are not national in nature. But if I know that someone broke a law in all the way across the country that might not affect me, might not have been murder, might have been something very local, but he broke the law and I have him near me, I can catch him. And if he's wanted and is supposed to pay a penalty or due time because, or let's say that he didn't show up for the trial and escaped and he's is wanted because he doesn't want to pay, let's say it was a heavy penalty and he doesn't want to pay it, so he escaped the state. I still have the responsibility as a police officer to enforce the local law of a state completely all the way across the country. Simple as that. So that's branch number one of the enforcers. The second branch is the prosecutors. And I would prefer to call them penalty assessors. And these are the people who then take the people arrested by the police or indicted or whatever, arrested by the police and then or accused by the police and then prosecute them to see, okay, they caught you, the police caught you shoplifting. Now we're going to assess whether you really did shoplift. And if so, how much time you'll do in jail or what financial penalty you'll pay. That's the second branch, the prosecutors. And that includes, you know, the people who will accuse the person or the people who will, quote, defend the person. And as you can see, that all sounds a lot like the judicial branch. And yes, that is correct. The entire judicial branch will be inside this department. This department is inside Congress. And you go, oh, wait, so you're saying that the judicial branch is no longer external and it's going to be inside the legislative branch? Yes, you heard correctly. That's exactly how it's supposed to be. Why? Because as we've said before, judges are referees. That's all they are. They are there to apply the laws of the land on the people. The laws of the land, not their own opinions, the laws of the land. Who passes the laws of the land? The Congress. So who is their boss? Congress. Congress passes the laws that they're supposed to enforce. So it makes perfect sense that they are employees of Congress. So this eliminates the judge's temptation to fashion their own legislation because they're just there. See, right now, the judges are all mighty and haughty, are high and mighty right now because they've been given their own branch, so they're independent. And then every time they show up in a room, everybody has to stand up. Stand up because Your Highness, Judge so-and-so has entered the room. And everybody stands up like, oh. And then the judge sits down and says, oh, thou shalt sit down. And everybody sits down. So you start doing that. They're their own branch. And then everybody has to say, judge, and oh, your highness, and all that, and your honor, and blah, blah, blah. Then what happens? The judge starts thinking, oh, I'm God. I can do whatever I want. I can decide who is guilty, who's not guilty, and if I don't like the law that I'm being given, I can fudge it and I can make up some excuse to kind of get around it and so forth. And because I am the judge, and how dare you question me? And that arrogance that so many judges in the American system exude, that'd be gone because they're just employees. They're just like the police officer. Police officer. You know, he's there to enforce the law, you know, to grab the criminal. So the judge is not, you know, out in the streets grabbing the shoplifter. But the police officer does this duty that's been assigned to him to go grab the shoplifter and hold him. And then the judge like another employee, is just there to assess, okay, you know, how much time is this person going to serve? Is there enough evidence to prove that he or she was indeed shoplifting? And so forth. So the entire judicial branch will be here. And then the concept of judicial review that we have in America, and by judicial review, I mean, that's the phrase that people use to in America to refer to the judicial branch's ability to declare a certain law invalid because it's, let's say, unconstitutional or whatever. They find something wrong with the law, so they can strike it down. You know, just like what happened with Roe v. Wade, where a judge decided the laws against abortion are unconstitutional because they violate the right to privacy or whatever. And where is that right to privacy in the Constitution? Who knows? They keep, you know, fudging and you know, we've described this in detail before, the ambiguity of the whole thing. And judges with their arrogance and their sense of I'm God, start deciding what is a valid law and what isn't. Well, all that's gone. The judicial review system will be gone. A judge cannot strike down a law because there's a conflict of interest. He's an employee of the Congress. He's there to enforce the laws. And who hired the people in Congress? The people of that nation. I was going to say the American people, but you know, not anymore. The people of that nation put those Congress, those MCs in power, who then pass the laws that he has to apply. So the people employ the MC, the MCs employ the judge. Enable tyranny? That where the MCs can do whatever they want? Well, there's certain things to consider, first of all. It's not a single MC. It's not like it's one guy dictating all the law of the land. It's 400 or plus people, let's say, in a population the size of the United States. right now, I think, I forget how many Congress people we have, but I think it's 400 something. But regardless, it's going to be a whole bunch of people deciding these laws. So it's not just, that's one thing. The second thing is that we already have, in this system that we're describing, checks and balances, in the sense of that there's a house of sentries that is looking into the laws being passed and questioning them. It's a branch basically dedicated to kind of judicial review, but without the full-blown authority to strike down any law that they fancy should be stricken down, because that's what we have here. One judge somewhere can strike down a law, and then that law is no longer valid. One guy can strike down a law that was voted on by 400 people. And then we have to go through this process where, you know, that verdict can be appealed to the next higher level. And then, you know, all the judges stick together and they start upholding the other guy's verdict. And then one guy was able to, on his own, basically strike down the whole law passed by 400 people elected by 300 million Americans. And it's all arbitrary and ambiguous. So there is no judicial review in that sense. We have the House of Sentries who will, as a group, be evaluating laws. Not one single judge, a whole group of people whose job will be to be looking at the laws. And then they can veto a law if they are enraged enough about it. If it's really that bad, if they can garner a two-thirds majority, they can veto a law. But see, that then there's a process, and there's but even if they don't have the two-thirds majority, they can issue a declaration via a 50% plus one majority, or even if they don't have a majority, individual members of the House of Sentries can issue declarations, and they will have the budget to, you know, they'll have a website or whatever, and they will have a way to get that message out to the public, even if it's just one house of one century who is finding fault with a law. And then who is the final judge? The American people, because the people will hear, hey, the House of Centuries is complaining about this law. And yeah, maybe they're right, because the House of Centuries will have influence on the American people. And then they can say, well, let's vote these MCs, these bums out of power, and let's put in people who will change that law, because I think the Centuries were right. See, there is going to be review, it's just different. But it's not the judicial branch. That was a terrible, terrible, terrible mistake that the Founding Fathers made when they enabled that, because the whole system was wrong to begin with. So the judicial review by the judicial branch was the kind of the only thing left to deal with bad laws. But the whole system, with the branches like that, was broken to begin with. So that was the best we could do under that broken system. But now that we are fixing the system, then the judicial review thing goes away and it's not needed. But having said that, a judicial review can have will exist in a certain way, but only as an advisory role. In other words, if a judge deems a certain law unconstitutional or invalid or violating one of the five fundamental human rights and so forth, he can propose that that is a bill. Let's give a more radical example. Let's say that there's a citizen out there who feels that a certain law passed somewhere, maybe at the local level or national level, who knows, violated his rights. So he sues the federal, not the federal, but the government. So he goes to court into this system, into the prosecutor's department, and or penalty assessor's department, or however you want to call it. And he says, hey, I'm suing Congress because this law violated my human rights. Then the judge, can listen to his case and so forth, and say, yes, that law is unconstitutional, violated so-and-so's human rights. So that would be legal, but that verdict would only have an advisory role. It just like says, I have assessed it, and I find this law unconstitutional. And then that verdict will be entered as a bill in the House of Centuries, to go through the normal process, because the House of Centuries can also pass bills, as we described before, but they're non-binding. House of Centuries can pass a bill, and that bill automatically goes into the queue of Congress. So it will make it into Congress eventually. So the judge can issue a verdict. Yes, this law is unconstitutional. That goes, that will be entered as a bill in the House of Centuries. And if the House of Centuries says, oh yeah, this guy is right, and they vote on it and say, okay, so the House of Centuries has passed a bill upholding the verdict of the judge, then just like any other House of Centuries bill, it will go into the House of Commons or House of Representatives queue, just like any other bill passed by the House of Centuries. And then if it gets voted on in the House of Commons or House of Representatives by the MCs, then it becomes the law of the land, and the previous law gets reversed. If you see what I'm saying, there's a flow. So there's a way to deal with it. But the thing is not to let an implementer of laws start deciding what laws he likes and he doesn't like, and start messing with the system, and just willy-nilly on his own deciding, I, God of the universe, have decreed that this law is unconstitutional. No such thing anymore. Having said that, the other thing is, these are employees. These judges are employees of Congress inside this Department of Prosecutors and or penalty assessors. But the level of direct appointment by Congress may have to go a little deeper in this particular department, because generally I would dare say the Congress would just appoint a head of department, and that head has the freedom to appoint, you know, all the people underneath him and all the hierarchies and so forth. But in the case of judges, the Congress might have to go certain levels deeper. But we'll go into more detail about that, I think, in another recording, if possible. But I think that in the case of judges, they might not have the Congress might have to appoint. There's going to be a head of this department of prosecutors, a head judge, shall we say, or head. But he's not just a judge, because we have to clarify this. This department doesn't have judges only; it has all sorts of people. It has judges. It has prosecutors and defenders. But there's going to be a head of this department. This is the person who in normal circumstances would be able to appoint judges. But in this case, the Congress might have to not only appoint the head of the department, but also several levels down, so that up until certain levels of judges, they would have control over who is a judge and who isn't, let's say. And another thing worth saying is that there will be no Supreme Court as we have it now. It's just one judicial branch. That's all it is. And yes, it will be local. It will be divided into geographical regions, you know, just out of, for administrative purposes. So, you know, certain judge in a city or a county dealing with cases in that county and so forth. And there will be maybe higher level judges that deal with more national issues. But I would say that we'll talk about this a little more, this judicial branch or this prosecutor department in more detail. But I believe that we should try to keep the judicial process as local as possible, without having like a big caste or elite national judges, the way we have with the Supreme Court. There would be no Supreme Court anymore. It'd be much more divided and localized. So maybe national judges in the sense of judging over issues that transcend geographical regions, like something that affects the whole country, but it's more in these are judges, national judges, in terms of just the scope of the problem being dealt with, but not in terms of power, if that makes any sense. So let's say that there's some issue related to problems across the country, then a judge would be involved in that case, as opposed to an issue that's related to, that's circumscribed to a specific county, where a county judge would do the job. But it's not as if the national judge is a superior judge, if that makes any sense. He's not superior to the county judge. He's just dealing with things that have to do with national issues, of a wider scope. But he's not in authority over the local judge, if that makes any sense. He cannot override what the local judge decided just because he's a national judge, the way, for example, the Supreme Court does right now. So it'd be a very different system. It wouldn't be that hierarchical system of layers of appeals and all that stuff, because that creates power clots. But we'll talk about that, I guess, if allowed in detail in another recording. But it's worth emphasizing here that the public defenders will be employees of this department when they may have a private practice, you could say, but the moment they enter into a court case, kind of like what happens now in America, that they become officers of the court. So they become, in that sense, employees of the prosecutor's department, temporarily. So, and they're there to defend someone, but they are there to they're not going to be hired guns. In other words, they're not going to be hired by, they're not going to be paid by the defendant. They're going to be paid by the prosecutor's department. And you say, is there a conflict of interest? No, there isn't. Because they're going to be paid a fixed salary. It's not like they're going to get paid more or paid less. And there is an obligation by the prosecutor's department to provide this defendant with all the resources that he or she needs to defend the defendant, but that public defender will not be there as a hired gun to get the client off the hook. He or she's going to be there to defend the client in everything where where that defendant is on the side of truth. And if the defendant, let's say the defendant committed the crime and did it, that defender is under this constitution, he is responsible to not, he's going to be accountable legally and morally if he defends someone that he knows is guilty of a violation of a human right, and who is using legal mechanisms to cover up that person's crime. It's a very different system where everybody pledges loyalty to the truth, not to their client, but to the truth, not to the government, not to the prosecutor, even the prosecutors. They have this responsibility to uphold the truth. If someone is really not guilty, they can't just try to make him guilty just to win the case. And by the same token, the defender cannot just manipulate the law just to make his client or the defendant look innocent when he really isn't. It's a much more detached system where people are objectively, that's why they're called the prosecutors or the penalty assessors, because the defenders are just there to kind of just try to find the other side of the story to see if the accusation against the defendant holds up or not, and to see it. It's like, and we'll talk about this later, as well, that these lawyers, there's going to be a difference between lawyers and investigators. But and that's why this prosecutor's branch is more than just judges. That's what I'm trying to say. There are going to be judges, there's going to be prosecutors, there are going to be defenders, and there are going to be investigators on both sides. But we'll talk about that, later. But that's the second branch. A second department of enforcers. First is the police, as they would say in some neighborhoods, and I kind of prefer that pronunciation. There's the police, that's one department of enforcers, and then there's the prosecutors or penalty assessors. They're there to assess the penalty that is to be applied to someone captured by the police. And then the third enforcement branch would be prison, or what I'd call the penalty appliers. And obviously, you know, they, once someone has been found guilty, the prison department will be the, or the penalty applier department, the PAD, the PAD, will be responsible for enforcing the punishment, the penalty that has been applied on the individual. And as we have tried to explain before, the focus of this department of the prison system under a new, under the new constitution would be, the focus would be isolation. It would be not the prison system where it's like everybody gets together in the yard at lunchtime and they start, you know, forming little gangs inside the prison system and groups, and they even start planning crimes from inside jail. They learn each other's secrets, and so they, it becomes like a criminal university where criminals go and you know, get masters and PhDs in how to commit crimes, because they're in constant communion and communication with each other, and someone who maybe started out as a petty criminal starts becoming a career criminal because of the exposure in prison. Now, it's isolation. Everybody's living in this small, enclosed place with their toilet and, you know, some way to shower or bathe or clean themselves up every day. And that's it. That's it. They, maybe they can come go out and walk a while on appointed times by themselves, but they'll be isolated, and they may have books, be given books, or maybe a computer with a very, you know, very limited access, you know, with strict control over what they can access, and they can study. You know, they want to do something with their time, they can study. And think about their crime. And I can assure you that if we have a system like that, we can have much shorter penalties. Like, for example, instead of holding someone for 10 years, you could hold them for 2 years. And I can assure you, 2 years of isolation is going to be hell on earth. It's going to feel like 400 years to that person. So about 10 years in the slammer where you're, you go around, you can play tennis, or I don't know what they play, or, you know, and go to the prison gym and work out and talk to all the other criminals. It becomes like a club, you know, kind of a tough club, but so it's not a punishment. People should dread just the very thought, criminals. And not, you know, normal people dread going to prison because of all the bad people there. But I mean, the bad people should dread going to prison. The bad people don't dread going to prison now because it's like, oh, I'm going to go meet up with Joe and Billy Bob and all these other friends I made the other time that I was in prison. They are comfortable in the environment of bad people. But bad people should actually fear the thought of being 1 month in prison. Not because they're going to be beaten up. We're not talking about, you know, them being flogged and waterboarded or anything like that. It's just them just being put in a very small cell by themselves. No inmate, no buddies, no cellmates or whatever. On their own, just one bed, and a toilet, and maybe a table, and maybe a very very low budget computer with restricted internet access, and all they can, and maybe pen and paper, and all they can do is learn and study all day and think about what they've done. And I can assure you that we can issue much shorter sentences and produce much deeper transformations in people with a system like that. And this prison department, or penalty applier department, will may have special services for the prisoners, but those services, if there are services where they are tending to the prisoner, those services will be provided by other departments that are focused on service. For example, if they need to provide psychological services to certain prisoners, the psychologists that would be used for that would not work under the Department of Prisons, because it would see the thing is the Department of Prisons is a department of enforcers, so you require, that requires a certain mentality, a certain mindset, you can't be an enforcer and then serve someone at the same time. It's like you have to turn yourself into someone else. So anyone who is providing services that attend to the needs of these prisoners will have to come from departments related to the server branch. They will have to come in, and they don't answer to the prison department. They answer to the department they came from, if that makes any sense. Because it's a different personality. But if I come as a worker of the Department of Prisons, and the Department of Prisons is an enforcer, then I come with a different mindset. It's like a conflict of interest. It's like trying to do two things that are incompatible with each other. So the Department of Prisons would hire or get people from other departments to provide these services, and then the guards and everybody else, they would stay in the I am the enforcer mode, and I'm here to apply a penalty on you, sucker. That sort of mindset, as opposed to someone who's saying I'm here to help you and provide the service for you. So there'd be that separation. And again, these departments are not to have a service quality to them. They're not here to serve. They're here to enforce. They're here to go after what or who is against the law and to protect what or who is consistent with the law. So they are there to, you know, in a gunfight, let's say that someone is threatening someone with a gun, then they come in and they confront the guy with the gun. They get into a shootout with the gunman, and they're there to eliminate the threat against the innocent, and the innocent can be, you know, stand behind the policeman and take cover. And the policeman is there attacking the offenders. He has to go on offense. He has that mindset. He's protecting the innocent, but he's not there protecting in the sense of, you know, how can I help you? Do you want a cup of tea? You know, do you want some biscuits with that? You know, he's not there to do that. He's protecting the person. And in protecting, it's like saying, stand behind me. I'm going to shoot this guy and kill him because he's threatening you. You know, that sort of mindset. They don't have the service quality in the sense of serving, because there will be times where they will be helping people in need and so forth. But what I'm trying to say is that the department itself will be more oriented towards towards enforcing law and protecting people. Maybe a police officer might see that someone's car, is broken in the middle of the road and try to assist the person. Yeah, there's a certain service quality there, but it's not going to be their main course, main cup of tea. So there are enforcers. So there are these three branches inside the Congress to enforce the legislation passed by Congress: the police, the prosecutors, and the prison departments. Those are the three enforcer departments. And now we can start getting into the implementation departments, and there are five of them. Two of them are in the server branch, and three of them are in the organizer branch. So that's how it would work. And for some reason, I feel that we need to stop there. So we didn't really get to the server branch and the organizer branch, but let me just say this before stopping. And this is where things get confusing, because the server branch, which has two departments that we will talk about, I hope, in the next audio recording, and the organizer branch, which has three departments, will be inside the legislative branch. In other words, under Congress. And I know that's confusing. So you're saying the two branches, the two other branches, are inside another branch? Yes, that's what I'm saying. Why? Because the server and organizer branches are there, their departments are there to once again implement things that have been passed by Congress. In other words, let's say there's a department, I don't know, I'm just giving an example, and it's one of the two departments, but one of the two departments we'll talk about later may be in charge at some point in some under certain circumstances of providing food for the needy, let's say. But see, that server branch cannot independently decide, oh, we're going to give food to such and such people. They can't decide that because that's not their money to begin with. So if there is going to be a program to provide certain food to certain people, it has to have been passed as a law first. And that's the way we have our system now, so it's not like we're changing that. So the only reason why there be a program to feed certain people certain food is because the Congress at some point passed a law enabling that provision of food, if that makes any sense. So the whatever department enforces or implements that food program is implementing a piece of legislation. So therefore, just like any other department that implements or enforces legislation passed by Congress, it has to be under Congress, because Congress is the boss. Congress is the owner, in that analogy we were describing earlier. Congress is saying, we want to feed people over 60. Let's say that example, a silly example of people over 60 must be given a free soda every Thursday afternoon. Then we need a department that carries out that service, that, you know, it deals with the logistics and makes sure that every person over 60 gets a free soda if they want it on Thursday afternoons. But if the Congress didn't pass that law, then that department that provides that would provide that has no authority to hand out free sodas, because first of all, it wouldn't have the budget to do it, wouldn't have the assigned budget to do it, and it doesn't have the authority. They can't decide on their own. Therefore, any type of service provided has to be inside the legislative branch. So in a sense, the legislative branch is the Congress at the very top passing legislation, and then there are eight departments underneath. There's a second layer, the second layer that we just tried to describe in this recording, the enforcement departments. Those are, I don't know if they're a layer. I don't know if that's a layer or just in terms of position, just think of a triangle. The very top, you have Congress. Then at the middle, even though it's not exactly a layer, but it's you have the three enforcer departments, the Department of of the police department, the prosecutor's department, and the prison department. And then you have the other. Yeah, it might be a little incorrect to call the three enforcer departments the second layer, because the eight departments kind of function a little bit autonomously, you could say. So they kind of float inside the triangle in a sense. But in terms of organizing, we could put the first three at the top, the three enforcer departments. And then you have the other five. Two that are going to be server departments from the server branch, and three that are going to be from the organizer branch. And that's how the system works. And if you think about it from the perspective of the human personalities, we would end up having the two female personalities submitted under the judgments of the judge personality. And the judge personality being influenced by the visionary personality of the House of Centuries and the conqueror personality of the president. So you would have the female personality submitted under the male personalities. So it seems a little strange, but I think that in a certain way it also fits the human anatomy. As you know, the judge personality has to do with the mind, because you think in your mind and you judge things, so it's related to your mind. The visionary is more related to your emotions, and then the conqueror personality has to do with your will. What you decide to do. I will to do this, and I will win this, and I will conquer this. You know, it has to do with the will. So, the judge personality, physically, anatomically speaking, kind of resides, since it's connected to our minds, then it makes sense that it's connected to our brain, to our physical brain. And in that brain, the brain encompasses a whole bunch of things, and it's like the female personalities, so you have the female personalities living inside the legislative branch, just like in the same way that our brain control so many things and not just our judging. And I know I may be stretching things a little bit, but I feel like there's something there, that there's something metaphysically correct about having these two female branches inside one of the male branches, especially the one that is directly related to our brain, which does so much more than make judgments. So I know that may seem like an excuse, but or kind of a very flimsy justification, but I do believe this is the way to go, because the departments are implementing laws, and the laws are decided between the legislative branch, the visionary, the House of Centuries, and the president. So you have the two female personalities under control, and not able to exercise a matriarchy the way we have in our current system, where the female personalities have taken over. And again, as we've explained a million times, this has nothing to do with literal male or female. It is mindsets. You can have a female, a physical female, manifesting male personality qualities. And by the same token, you can have a physical male acting like a female in terms of personalities. So, but the correct way of things is the female personalities must live under the male personalities submitted to them. And there's no better way than to have that happen with the two female branches inside the branch that is related to laws, to the producing of laws. But we'll talk about those two branches and their five departments in a future audio snippet, hopefully, if allowed. I hope all of this is making sense. This might not be the perfect solution, but I believe it gets close to it because it's metaphysically, it seems to be metaphysically valid in many ways. And so we'll talk about the other two branches in the next audio snippet, hopefully. And we'll also be trying to clarify some other things, including how the judicial component works, which is inside the Department of Prosecutors. We'll talk about that in greater detail later as well, hopefully. Thank you very much for listening.